We are continuing our study of the Gospel of Matthew and looking at chapter 2 this morning, the sort of famous story of the wise men. Last week we talked about the birth of Christ, how he is God, become man, how Jesus was born of a virgin, and how he had come to rule. Matthew is really clearly presenting Jesus in his Gospel as a king. And that reality is going to be seen even more so today by the reaction of the wise men, the reaction of Herod to this king's arrival. To begin, we're just going to jump right in verse 1. Matthew writes, "After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, 'Where is he who has been born, king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him.'" Now, this has always been to me a sort of mysterious story. These random guys from a foreign land show up. And they ask for the king. Where's the king? Where is this king who's been born? And they say, "We know he's been born because we saw his star." Now this brings up to me a whole host of questions. Because it's clear these are not Jewish men. These are from some foreign country, some land in the east. How do they even know about the Messiah? How do they know that there's going to be a king born in Israel? How are they looking for the king of the Jews to arrive? Furthermore, what is this about a star rising? Stars don't really move around. And further, how would you get all of that out of a star? So let's say you're an astrologer, you look up at the stars every night, you study them carefully. One day a brand new star suddenly appears and you say to yourself, well, there must have been a king born in Israel. You know, that's just the logical result there. It's an oddly specific insight for them to arrive at. And so clearly these men must have had more information than just merely seeing a star in the distance. They must have had some familiarity with the Old Testament prophets, the prophecies of the coming king, and so they connected this star's appearance in the sky to the birth of the king. And here's one such prophecy that maybe was informing their thinking. We'll get to how they maybe knew about the Old Testament prophets not being from Israel. We'll get to that in a minute. But here's one such prophecy. Numbers 24, verse 17 says, "I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not near. A star shall come out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel. It shall crush the forehead of Moab and break down all the sons of Sheth." So you see there a star coming out of Jacob, which indicates that a ruler has been born. This scepter will rise, which is a symbolic of a king rising up from Israel. And of course, there's all sorts of debates about whether this star was actually a comet or a convergence of planets or whatever. You can read all sorts of theories about this. That's the sort of thing seminary students write their doctoral dissertations on, is theories about what this star was. I don't really know. Personally, I think it was maybe an angel. There's a lot of indications in Scripture that are connecting stars and angels. And frankly, I don't see how a star can come to rest over a house in Bethlehem without burning up the whole village. So I doubt that it was a normal star. But clearly, whatever this was, it was a bright light that was visible to them. How God did it exactly, I leave up to him. Back to our text, verse 1 says that these wise men were coming from the east. So let's talk about these wise men. The Greek word here translated wise men there in verse 1 is magos. Maybe you've heard them referred to before as the magi. That's sort of a transliteration of this Greek word. These magi, or these wise men, came from the east, what would be the Parthian Empire. Okay, so during the days of Jesus, you had two great empires in the world. You had in the west, the Roman Empire, in the east, the Parthian Empire. And these magi, according to Matthew, came from the east. We can see from Matthew 2 that they were no ordinary men. These may have been kings. That's sort of the tradition. Whether that's true or not is up for debate. If not, they were certainly men of nobility and importance, maybe the king's advisors more than kings themselves. But not just anyone could come into Jerusalem and have a personal meeting with King Herod. Not just anyone would have gifts like gold, frankincense, and myrrh to give. And so these were clearly wealthy, important men of nobility, at least some sort of dignitaries in the Parthian Empire. These magi or wise men, they do show up one other place in Scripture, and that is in the book of Daniel. So in ancient Babylon had been conquered at this point. The land had passed hands a few times until you get to the first century here. And so now Babylon was a part of the Parthian Empire during the days of Jesus. And so these magi were likely descendants of the magi of Daniel's time in Babylon. So for a little historical context, let's back up to the book of Daniel. You remember Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon. He was the one who attacked Jerusalem. He took many of the Hebrew people captive. He brought them in exile back to Babylon. And among those who was taken sort of as a slave from his homeland in Israel was Daniel. Daniel had the ability given to him by God to interpret dreams. This is probably what he's most famous for. King Nebuchadnezzar had a dream one night, and it really bothered him. Daniel chapter 2, verse 1 says, "In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. His spirit was troubled, and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans, be summoned to tell the king his dreams." So they came in and stood before the king. So right there you see the word magicians in Daniel chapter 2. In the Greek translation of the Old Testament, known as the Septuagint, that word magician here is the same Greek word as in the book of Matthew when it talks about the magi, the wise men. So here in Daniel, the magi are here and they're coming to interpret or try to interpret the king's dream. And most scholars believe that the magi of Jesus' day were descendants of these magi in ancient Babylon. Verse 3, "The king said to them, 'I had a dream, and my spirit is troubled to know the dream.'" So he wants to know, what does this mean? "The Chaldean said to the king in Aramaic, 'O king, live forever. Tell your servants the dream, and we will show the interpretation.' The king answered and said to the Chaldeans, 'The word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb, and your houses shall be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you shall receive from me gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation.'" So these magicians that are supposed to be these wise guys that can, you know, do magical things, they come to the king and they say, "Okay, tell us what your dream was and we'll interpret it for you." Nebuchadnezzar says, "Well, I'm not just going to tell you my dream so you can come up with some story and I can't verify if it's actually what it means or not. I want to know if you guys are legit, so here's my test. You tell me my dream. Okay, if you guys are really magicians, you know, what do I pay you for? You should be able to tell me what my dream was and what it means." And so he says, "If you do this, I'll know that you're real and you'll receive great honor and treasures, whatever you want. And if you don't tell me what my dream was and what it means, I will rip your limbs off your body." Okay, verse 10. "Chaldeans answered the king and said, 'There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great and powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean.'" So they're sort of admitting here they don't actually have magical powers here. They're the sort of palm readers of today who just come up with things to tell you that seem like it might be real. And again, this same word here, magician, is the word magi in Matthew. So they say, you know, no magi, none of the wise men in our land can tell the king what he dreamed. Verse 11. "The thing that the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods, whose dwelling is not with flesh." So they say to the king, "What you're asking is not humanly possible." Verse 12, "Because of this, the king was angry and very furious." He's like, you know, what am I paying you guys for? You guys can't even do this. And so he commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. I mean, why even have magicians, right, if they can't pull off a simple trick like this? Verse 13, "So the decree went out. The wise men were to be killed, and they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them." So Daniel was associated with this group of wise men in Babylon. "Then Daniel replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard, who had gone out to kill the wise men from Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, 'Why is the decree of the king so urgent?'" Like, what is the rush? Calm down a minute. Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. Verse 24, "Then Daniel went into Arioch, whom the king had appointed to destroy the wise men of Babylon. He went and said thus to him, 'Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon. Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation.' Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said thus to him, 'I have found among the exiles from Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation.' The king declared to Daniel, whose name was Belteshazzar, 'Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation?' Daniel answered the king and said, No wise men, enchanters, magicians, or astrologers can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked. Now, notice the little added detail here in Daniel where he says that they were also astrologers. So these group of wise men, these magicians in Babylon, were also interested in astrology. They studied the stars, which is just another piece of evidence that seems to tie them to the same group centuries later, looking at the stars and coming to see Jesus. Verse 28, so he says, none of your wise men, none of your magicians or astrologers can do this, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. And he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will be in the latter days. Your dream and the visions of your head as you lay in bed are these. And so Daniel's going to go on to tell Nebuchadnezzar both his dream, what he saw, and the interpretation, what it means. We'll read that in a second. But clearly a pretty strong case can be made here that the Magi of Jesus' day were descendants of the Magi mentioned back in Daniel a few centuries earlier. They were interested in astrology. They would have been familiar with the prophecies of Daniel, which I think explains how they could have known to be looking for the arrival of a king in Israel. And I believe that these Magi from the East knew about this promised ruler in this kingdom that was coming to Israel because of their familiarity with Daniel's prophecies. To me, it's really the only way they could have known to be on the lookout for this king, because Daniel has a lot to say about Jesus. For example, here's the dream, the interpretation that Daniel gives to Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 31 says, you saw, O king, and behold, a great image. So there's this huge statue. This image, mighty and of exceeding brightness, stood before you, and its appearance was frightening. The head of this image was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its middle and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. As you looked, a stone was cut out by no human hand and struck the image on its feet of iron and clay and broke them in pieces. Then the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold all together were broken in pieces and became like chaff of the summer threshing floors, and the wind carried them away, so that not a trace of them could be found. But the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. So that's the dream. Nebuchadnezzar sees this huge statue in his dream. The head is of gold and the rest of it's, you know, bronze, silver, iron, different materials. And in his dream, a rock comes, strikes the feet of the statue, and the whole thing falls apart. And then this rock grows into a huge mountain that takes over the whole world. It's a strange dream. So here's the interpretation, verse 37. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom God, the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, the glory, and into whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of men, the beasts of the field, the birds of heaven, he's making you rule over them all. You are the head of gold. So the head of gold on this statue represents Nebuchadnezzar and the kingdom of Babylon. The Babylonian Empire, the greatest, the most powerful empire in the world at this time. Verse 39. Another kingdom, inferior to you, shall rise after you. So after the Babylonian Empire, we know from history, comes the Medo-Persian Empire. This was inferior in terms of its power. And then he says, and after that, a third kingdom of bronze, which shall rule over all the earth. The third kingdom would be the Greek Empire, which conquered the Medo-Persian Empire and took over. The Greeks ruled over a vast territory. And so verse 40 says that there's going to be a fourth kingdom, strong as iron, because iron breaks to pieces and shatters things. And like iron that crushes, it shall break and crush all of these. And as you saw, the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, it shall be a divided kingdom. But some of the firmness of iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with the soft clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly iron, partly clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly brittle. And as you saw iron mixed with soft clay, so they will mix with one another in marriage, but will not hold together, just as iron does not mix with clay. So, this is the fourth kingdom, which would be the Roman Empire. It was strong, it was powerful, but it was also divided and it had an inherent weakness in it. And eventually it fragments and falls apart. Again, Daniel's prophecy is fascinating to read in light of the history that we know took place exactly as he predicted. Verse 44, in the days of those kings, this would be in the days of the Roman Empire, this fragmented kingdom, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom that shall never be destroyed, nor shall the kingdom be left to other people. It shall break in pieces all these kingdoms and bring them to an end, and it shall stand forever. So Daniel says, the dream that you dreamed, that rock that comes, is the kingdom of God. It is the kingdom of Christ. In those days, God himself is going to set up a kingdom on earth, and it's never going to be conquered. All these other kingdoms that came before are going to be taken over by some other group, but God's king is going to rule forever. His kingdom will break in pieces all of these other kingdoms and bring them to an end, and his rule will stand forever. So, how did the Magi in the East know that a king was coming during the Roman Empire, specifically, and that this king is going to rule over all the other nations? Well, Daniel very clearly told them. Of course, after giving this dream and the interpretations, Nebuchadnezzar's impressed, and so he elevates Daniel above all of the other Magi. He became very influential in Babylon, specifically to this group. And so I believe that these prophecies of Daniel were handed down by the Magi and the astrologers, and so they were looking for centuries to the fulfillment of this prophecy, and they knew it was going to happen during the Roman Empire, that fourth kingdom that had come. And so they were waiting for the arrival of the king. Here's another of Daniel's prophecy of this coming king. It's not just in chapter 2. Several times in the book of Daniel, he talks about the coming of Christ and his kingdom. For example, chapter 7, verse 13, Daniel says, I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. And he came to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. And to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all peoples and nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So Daniel very clearly prophesied the arrival of this king. And Daniel's influence, his prominence in Babylon, seems to explain how these Magi, a few centuries later, would have known to be on the lookout for this coming king from Israel. And I think some of these Magi may have come to truly believe in the God of Israel, the God of Daniel. And so they were looking for that coming kingdom of God. They knew it was going to be soon during the reign of the Roman Empire. And when they saw the star, they took that as a sign that the king had finally arrived. Back to our text, verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Let's talk about Herod for just a minute. Herod was a wicked man. Romans had made him king over the region of Israel, more like a governor. He was still under the Roman Empire's authority, but they had given him a certain jurisdiction there in Judea. Herod had 10 wives, we know from history. He was a powerful man, and he was ruthless. He was jealous. He was insecure, always afraid of losing his power. And so he had a habit of killing anyone who he saw as a potential threat to his throne, including his own family members. Herod killed one of his wives, killed one of his wife's brothers, killed his own mother-in-law. Maybe we can understand that one. And he killed several of his own sons. His own children Herod put to death when he thought that they were going to make a play for the throne. While he was nearing death, Herod famously gave orders for 400 of the most noble and distinguished men in Israel to be slaughtered the moment that he died, because he wanted the city of Jerusalem to be mourning on the day of his death rather than rejoicing. That's the kind of man that Herod was. So Herod hears that this king's been born, and he's troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. They're scared of what Herod's going to do in response to this news. Herod reminds me of the faith of the demons in James chapter 2. You know, you believe in one God, you do well. The devils believe also and tremble. Herod hears this report about the king being born. He believed it. But it wasn't the kind of belief that results in obedience. It was the kind of belief that causes anger and fear and opposition. Verse 4, Herod assembles all the chief priests, the scribes of the people, He inquired of them where the Christ was to be born. So Herod calls together all the Bible scholars. You know, these are the students of the Old Testament scriptures. He asks them, where is this king? This king that's promised to Israel, where is he supposed to be born? Are there any prophecies which tell us what city he's going to come from? The wise men knew the answer. They knew he was going to come to Israel. The wise men knew he was going to come to Israel. They didn't know the exact city. And so it makes sense they would come to Jerusalem, the capital, you know, seeking the king. And so Herod consults with the Bible scholars. Here's their response, verse 5. They told him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. So the rabbis, the chief priests, the scribes of Israel, they were familiar with the Old Testament. They knew Micah's prophecy. This is in Micah chapter 5, which said that a ruler was to be born in Bethlehem. And so they tell Herod, Bethlehem is where he's going to be. Verse 7. Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly, and he ascertained from them what time the star had appeared. So he wants to know in specific detail, when exactly did you first see this star? Then he sends them to Bethlehem, saying, go, search diligently for the child, and when you have found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him. Of course, Herod has no such intentions. He's a pretty good actor. Verse 9. After listening to the king, they went their way, and behold, the star that they had seen when it rose went before them till it came to rest over the place where the child was. The walk to Bethlehem, not very far, by the way, it's just down the road. A few miles would have taken them probably a couple hours to walk there. So they're headed to Bethlehem. They see the star or this bright light, whatever it was, and it comes to rest over the place where the child was. Verse 10, when they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. And going into the house, they saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then, opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold and frankincense and myrrh. So a couple of things to note here. First of all, you notice it says here they arrived at a house, not a stable. Okay, this might ruin the nativity scene for you, but they were not there at the birth of Christ. They arrived when Jesus was a toddler. The star first appears when Jesus is born, but they're way off in the Parthian Empire. It takes them a long time to get there. And so, incidentally, when I was a boy, this is just me being ridiculous, but when my family would put up the nativity scene every Christmas, I would insist, you know, we'd put it on the mantle over the fireplace, and I would take the wise men and put them across the room because, you know, they're still on their way. So, there you go. Main thing to note here is the worship that they gave to the child. They bow down in reverence to Jesus. And they present him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And I know you've probably heard some interpretations about what these things represent, and frankly, I don't think they really represent anything. I don't think the wise men knew they were going to be in the Bible and intentionally chose these gifts for some sort of symbolic meaning. I think they just gave the most precious, valuable things that they had. These were gifts of great value, fitting to give to a king. Verse 12. Being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. Now when they had departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, rise, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you. For Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. So the angel tells the wise men, don't tell Herod where the child was. Go back to your own country. And then he tells Joseph, get Mary, get the child, leave immediately, go to Egypt. Herod's going to try to find the child and kill him. Verse 14, so he rose, he took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt. And they remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt I have called my son, quoting there from Hosea. And as we mentioned last time, Matthew brings up all these little details about Jesus' birth, his early life, just to show us that he fulfilled these scriptures. There's five prophecies here in the early chapters of Matthew, just showing us how all these things happened just as God had predicted centuries before. The king was to be born in Bethlehem, and yet he also comes out of Egypt, and as we'll see later, he'll end up in Galilee as well. So verse 16, we see the rage of Herod when he realized he's been tricked. You know, the wise men, they disobeyed his orders. They didn't come back and tell him where the child was. They snuck out of town. And so verse 16 says, when Herod saw that he'd been tricked by the wise men, he became furious, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all that region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had ascertained from the wise men. So he had made sure to get the information from the wise men. When exactly did this star first appear in the sky? And maybe they told him it was, you know, a year and a half ago. And so he rounds up just to be safe and says, kill all of the male children in this area, 2 years old and under. This is how terrified Herod the king was of this king who had been born. And once again, Matthew points out that this too, this awful act of Herod, this cruelty, was prophesied. Verse 17, then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, weeping and loud lamentation. Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be comforted because they are no more. This prophecy is found in Jeremiah 31. Ramah was located there in that region and was the burial place of Rachel, which is why she's connected to this location. Verse 19. But when Herod died, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt, saying, rise, take the child and his mother and go to the land of Israel, for those who sought the child's life are dead. And he rose and took the child and his mother and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was reigning over Judea in the place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. Now, he doesn't know if this son is going to be sort of cut from the same cloth as his dad. And so, being warned in a dream, he withdrew to the district of Galilee. And he went and lived in a city called Nazareth, so that what was spoken by the prophets might be fulfilled, that he would be called a Nazarene. Now, there's debate as to what prophecies Matthew has in focus here. There's no specific Old Testament prophecy mentioning Nazareth because the town of Nazareth didn't exist at the time of the writing of the Old Testament. But there are prophecies which speak of Christ coming to Galilee, to that region, none that mention the town specifically. Nazareth was established about 100 years before the birth of Christ, so this would be centuries after the time of the prophets. But we do have an interesting note in Isaiah. Isaiah chapter 11, verse 1 says, there shall come forth a shoot from the stump of Jesse, and a branch from his roots shall bear fruit. And the Hebrew word here for branch is netzar, and most biblical scholars think the city of Nazareth gets its name from this verse, predicting the coming of Christ. And so that may be what Matthew refers to here. So that's Matthew chapter 2. And I think there's a few main points we ought to take from this passage. First, clearly Matthew wants us to see Jesus as the King of Kings. He is the rock that Daniel prophesied that would destroy all the other kingdoms of the world, would take over, and his kingdom would never end. And Matthew chapter 2 demonstrates in dramatic fashion that Jesus is such a powerful king that other kings fear him. And they fear him in two different directions. Jesus is the kind of king that wise kings fear in a reverential way. They bow down and worship him. And Jesus is the kind of king whose authority is so absolute that it's a threat to evil kings. It's very rare, if you think about it, that a powerful figure like Herod would be so terrified of a toddler that he would try to have him killed. And it's also very strange for powerful, rich, foreign nobles to travel a long distance and come and bow down and worship to a toddler and give him their most valuable possessions. Can you imagine that scene? It's strange. It's bizarre to even picture that. But that's the point Matthew's making. This was no ordinary child. When we say that Jesus is king, we don't mean that in some ethereal way that has no relevance to our world. No, Jesus is king over us. He's been given authority to reign over the whole earth. All the kings of the earth are commanded to recognize his authority and submit to him. As Jesus told us in the Great Commission, all authority is mine, therefore go command the nations to obey me. When we say that Jesus is the King of Kings, we mean that quite literally. He's going to reign over all of the nations of the earth. The ends of the earth will belong to him. One day every king will recognize his authority over them. The Herods of the world will either kiss the Son or be crushed by him. This is the message of Daniel. This is the message of the Psalms. And this is the message that should be at the heart of our gospel. The gospel is not merely an invitation to accept. It is also a command that must be obeyed. It is a call to submit to the King, to become a subject of his eternal kingdom. And this leads to the reactions to the king's arrival. There's three reactions in this text that I want you to notice. One is wise, the other two are foolish. First, you have the reaction of the wise men. They hear that this king has arrived, this promised ruler, and so they come to worship him. Their reaction is one of submission, one of reverence. This is the wise response to Christ. They knew the prophecies. They knew that God had anointed this ruler to reign over all the world. And so you would be wise to come, to make peace with him, to align yourself on his side rather than trying in vain to oppose him. Which leads to the first foolish response, which is Herod. Herod hears the news that the king has come, and his response is one of fear. And that fear then leads to hatred and opposition. He tries to destroy this king. And as Psalm chapter 2 tells us, God laughs at such people, kings of the earth who think that they can conquer the king of heaven. Good luck with that. But what stands out to me the most is the third reaction, and that's the response of the scribes, the chief priests, the rabbis in Jerusalem. They hear the news that the king has been born, and they're clearly familiar with the prophecies about him, so much that they're the ones that are consulted when they ask what town he's going to be born in, and they immediately knew. But they treat it as sort of like a Bible trivia question with no real-world relevance. They give the correct answer. He's going to be born in Bethlehem. And then they go back to work. Contrast that with the response of the shepherds over in Luke's gospel. When they hear that Jesus is born in Bethlehem, they immediately run to go see him. And then when they encounter the baby, they go running throughout the streets of Jerusalem proclaiming that the king has been born. That's a fitting response. Those are people who get it, who understand the relevance of this event. The response of the chief priests and scribes is baffling. They hear that the promised king has been born. They knew exactly where he was supposed to be born, and they just don't seem to care. And so of these three reactions to Christ, reverence, resistance, and indifference, I think in America today, that last one may be the most common response. It's not that most people in America despise Jesus. Of course, there are some who hate him just as much as Herod did. But I don't think that's most people in our country today. It's also not that most people today have thoroughly investigated the claims of Christianity and simply don't believe them. I don't think that's even true of most Americans either. It's rather that they're busy. I mean, we've got work, we've got family obligations, kids got to have sports, got to keep up with our social media, you know. There's a game on today. Whatever it is, we're so busy and distracted by all of these other things going on in our life, and that's why we just don't have time for God, for church, for investigating the claims of Christianity. Maybe there's a God. Maybe there's an afterlife. Not really sure. Haven't thought too much about it. That's an attitude I've never been able to comprehend. What do you mean you haven't given it much thought? You don't have time to figure out the most important aspect of your life? You can't spare the energy to take a 2-mile walk down the road to Bethlehem and just investigate if maybe this is true. Maybe the king has really been born. The attitude of total indifference from the scribes is baffling. And so these are the three responses to Jesus, and they're the same responses we see today. Some bow in reverence, some walk away in indifference, and some choose resistance. And the question for each of us today is, how do we respond to Christ? Will we resist him? Will we rebel against Christ in vain? Or will we submit to him? Will we bow in reverence and recognize Jesus as our King? Or perhaps most tragically of all, will we simply walk away in indifference? What will you do with Jesus? Let's pray.